So, another week of techno-jerk and chief Elon Musk doing his impression of a really crap supervillain. According to some completely unconfirmed and sketchily sourced reports, he's now plotting how he can bring down the UK's democratically elected government. Most specifically, how he can somehow unseat Starmer as PM. Well, good luck with that. As I've noted time and time again, the UK's political system makes it extremely difficult to get rid of a government with a decently sized majority. Bearing in mind the size of this government's majority, I don't see any prospect of it losing a confidence vote in the Commons, meaning that, regardless of any destabilising attempts by outsiders, it's likely to run the full five-year term of this Parliament. Which is why all those polls that the right-wing press like to run, supposedly showing how unpopular Starmer and the government are, conducted exclusively amongst their own neo-Nazi readers, of course, are utterly meaningless at this point in time, as we won't be going to the polls any time soon. But even if Starmer could somehow be removed from number 10, what does Musk expect to happen? Because all that would happen would be that he'd be replaced by another senior Labour politician, unlikely to be any more sympathetic to Musk's right-wing fantasies than Starmer. But we shouldn't be surprised at Musk behaving in this way, as if he has the power to topple governments and foreign countries and bend their political systems to his will, regardless of local democratic processes. What else could be expected from a man whose father was behind the smuggling ring providing South African diamonds to Ernst Stavro Blofeld back in the early 70s in order to power his space laser with which he held the world to ransom? I mean, you've surely heard of that. They made a fictionalised account of it called Diamonds Are Forever in 1971. Now I know what you're thinking. Didn't Ian Fleming write the novel it was based on back in the 50s? Well, it might have shared a title, but the film ditched the plot, replacing it with a new, ripped-from-the-headline story. And before you say it, I know that Blofeld had appeared as a character in Fleming's books back in the 50s as well. But as was often the case, he used the name of a real would-be supervillain. I mean, back then, Blofeld was pretty much a two-bit minor gangster. However, spurred on by the notoriety given to him by Fleming's novels and his portrayal in the subsequent films, he decided to enter the big leagues and hatched his space laser plan. Now, his father's involvement with Blofeld obviously inspired Elon Musk to bankroll his own supervillain in the form of Donald Trump. Musk, however, has clearly concluded that he wants to be the villain himself rather than just being the shady sidekick providing the finance. Which is why we need to be wary of all those rockets he keeps trying to launch. Believe me, one day one of them is going to put a space laser into orbit. I mean, he's obviously learned the lessons of Blofeld's failure. His new position in Trump's government will allow him to starve the US's intelligence that serves as a finance, force them to sack all their best agents, so they can neither detect nor defeat his scheme. Well, his attacks on the UK obviously have the aim to try and neutralise the threat posed by MI6's 00 section. Not that I'm worried that he'll succeed, as I've no doubt that Musk will be every bit as crap as a supervillain as he has been in his other ventures. The catastrophic mismanagement of Twitter, all those exploding rockets, electric cars that catch fire and or crash when driving themselves, I mean, you know, need I say more? Most crucially, of course, he has absolutely no understanding of human beings, and the fact that the majority of them neither share his own opinion of his own genius or his enthusiasm for undermining democratic elected governments. We like being able to choose our own leaders, even if, as far as Musk is concerned, they are the wrong governments.
Give my stupidity, Leona, but what's a virgin?
Your card says you're a virgin.
Mr. Bixby, I'm looking for a virgin.
Virgins, and you thought I was a freak.
But this silly computer found not one, but three.
Now look here, Cupid. I have just about had it with you, baby.
And that's the story of The Curious Female.
Hello, Guy? This is Susan, the teasing little bitch.
Sensual, vibrant, lusty.
You can feel something. I know it.
I love you, and I want to marry you. But I don't intend to go without sex for the next 8 months.
Oh, make love to me. For Johnny's sake, Roma.
the computer and you've got trouble. Lots of it.
In fact, you've been asking for something all night, haven't you?
And no one knows what troubles virgins have.
Quest. Someone blonde, well-built.
And look who runs the dating service, the fairy godmother of the gay deceivers, Michael Greer. The shock orgy of all time. The curious female. Adults only. Positively no one admitted under 18.
1969's The Curious Female is basically a typical late 60s nudie movie, except for its presentation, styling itself as a film within a film. The actual nudie part is a softcore sex comedy called Three Virgins, which is enclosed within a futuristic framing device of having it secretly watched by a group of young underground movie enthusiasts. In between the reels of the Three Virgins, this future audience discussed the film and the strange 20th century morality and sexual norms it depicts, all to satirical purpose. The whole business of low-budget sex movie production is also satirised, with the young women presenting the film telling her audience that one reel of the film, supposedly chronicling a crucial plot point, was censored at the time of its release and is lost, while confiding to a male co-host, in reality it was never filmed because the producers ran out of money. The Curious Female itself was, of course, shot on a low budget, with its future world depicted in the simplest and most basic ways possible. All we really see is a whitewashed cellar with lots of futuristic curved spaces populated by young people wearing what looked like togas. We're told that in this future world, everything is controlled by a central computer, which has outlawed monogamy in ancient sex movies like Three Virgins. The dialogue elaborates this world a little more, telling us that at age 13, for instance, girls are, by order of the computer, relieved of their virginity by an approved old man. We aren't told if 13-year-old boys get similar treatment from either approved old men or old women. The Three Virgins, which we see episodically throughout the framing story, plays out like a regular sex movie of the era, with its college campus setting, mix of female leads, comic asides involving a computerized dating agency. We never learn if the 1969 computer is actually an ancestor of the central computer of the future, but the implication seems clear. Some of its assumptions while mashing up dates seem as eccentric as the rules enforced by the future machine, including matching up an adult man with a little girl. The film within a film's plot involves a client of the agency looking for virgins. There are apparently only three left on the books, although the computer later becomes confused and thinks that a woman from Virginia is a virgin. One girl wants to remain a virgin until she's married, but a bastard of a boyfriend wants only one thing and later gets it from her mother. When he finally relents and marries her, it turns out he's still a selfish bastard in the bedroom, completely ruining what she thought was going to be her wonderful sexual awakening. Another of the girls is escaping a home situation where she is constantly threatened with violence from her father and rape from her uncle. The third finds that the client looking for a virgin is a wealthy athlete who simply wants her as an accoutrement, reasoning that any woman still a virgin at her age isn't interested in sex and therefore won't bother him with any nasty physical demands, but still look decorative. Consequently, she starts having frenzied sex with a variety of men. Overall, The Curious Female isn't exactly a great or even groundbreaking film, but it is quite enjoyable while it's playing. Although clearly made with limited resources, it's actually pretty decently made, not looking too threadbare, with decent photography and sound quality, and direction from Paul Rapp, which, if not inspired, is at least competent. The cast, which includes Angelique Petitjean, are also decent enough, putting in more than passable performances, with the main female leads playing dual roles in both framing story and film within a film. All in all, The Curious Female is an agreeably, slightly offbeat take on the late 60s nudie movie.
Dapper's Aldrin guy became a total Fruit Loop after he came back from the moon. He once arrived at a NASA party dressed in a kitchen roll and wearing a plastic plant pot on his head. He reckoned it gave him protection from the moon's rays.
Yeah, I heard about that. Didn't he stir the punch bowl with his penis?
I once met this guy who said he'd been in space. I asked how farts behaved in zero gravity. He didn't answer me, but he did attempt to touch me up.
It's all bollocks. They never went to the moon at all. My gran reckons she saw them filming it on the beach at Weston-super-Mare back in 1969. She says if you look closely at the TV footage of the first landing, you can see the kiddies being given donkey rides reflected in Neil Armstrong's visor.
Nah, they defo went to the moon, at least the first one was real, anyway. When they got there they found the Nazis had already set up a colony there. The CIA had to brainwash them when they got back, that's why Aldrin went bonkers.
There was this piece in The Guardian the other day about how scientists fed radioactive chapatis to unsuspecting Punjabi women in Coventry during the 1960s as part of an experiment on iron absorption. Well, the article focused on the ethics and legality of experimenting on people without their consent. I couldn't help but feel disappointed that it didn't include commentary from any right-wing crackpots spinning conspiracy theories that it was all part of a secret plot by the then Labour government to create a race of super Asians. I mean, it writes itself, really. A new race of Asian immigrants who can work harder and longer than any white person for a lower hourly rate. It would explain everything. The mass unemployment amongst the traditional working classes of the 80s wasn't the fault of Thatcher's economic policies, but rather down to the rise of the new super Asians. In turn, this led to the disenfranchisement of the white working classes, resulting in them turning to the extreme right. Race riots? Well, they certainly weren't fomented by the extreme right in this alternate reality, but rather were acts of self-defence by white workers against their superpowered Asian oppressors. Fast forwarding to last summer, how come, despite being besieged by mobs of white rioters with firebombs, no mosques or hotels full of asylum seekers were burned down? Because they were being protected by groups of these super Asians, using their super strong breath to blow out the flames and their super speed to snatch firebombs from the hands of rioters before they could throw them. Doubtless, it will be claimed that these super Asians are also more virile than white men, hence the explosion in their numbers during the 70s and 80s. Their superpowers mean that they can just outbreed white Brits, turning us into a minority in our own cities. Worse, their powers of mind control are probably why so many white women fall for them, bearing their children, further diluting the race. To the demented of the extreme right, those radioactive chapatis are the explanation for several of our cities falling to the Asians as the super Asians forcibly took them over. No doubt, in their warped world, Sadiq Khan, Mayor of London, only won by using his hypnotic superpowers to get people to vote for him, and ignoring the fact that the women who are secretly irradiated were of Punjabi origin, while Khan is of Pakistani descent. But hey, they're all the same, aren't they? Mind you, some British politicians of Asian descent are definitely not super Asians. Rishi Sunak, Priti Patel, and Suella Braverman come to mind. Although supporters of Boris Johnson might argue that the only way that he could have been deposed was via Sunak using his superpowers to undermine him. But as noted, the article didn't include anything like this, which is very remiss of the author, as I'm sure that we would all welcome yet another crazy right-wing conspiracy theory that stokes racial divisions and reinforces cultural stereotypes. It's what we need right now. Something can explain all of the country's problems by tracing them back to some radioactive chapatis fed to Asian women in the Midlands by radical leftist scientists who were themselves probably hippies off their faces on LSD. I mean, it makes perfect sense, doesn't it?
Die, die, my darling. Die, die.
Harry?
Bye-bye, my darling. Bye-bye.
Ah!
Die.
Mr. Strip,
die, my darling. It's quite for the best that I lay you to rest. Die, die, my darling.
You never intended to remain true to dear Stephen.
They are insane. All of them.
Help! Get me out of here!
This gun is dangerous, Patricia.
Starring Tallulah Bankhead. Also starring Stephanie Powers as the Darling.
I'll pay you if you let me out of here.
In what way, love?
Don't!
Die. Die, my darling. Die. Die.
What will you do when Alan comes to get me? Beg for mercy? Cry?
No one is going to find you here, Patricia.
There's no one here to help, darling. Only to kill you, darling. Only to kill you. Or worse, darling.
Want the car, do you?
You know what the price is, though, don't you?
One of the most terrifying suspense thrillers this side of insanity. Die, die, my darling.
You must die. Die, my darling.
You know, somewhere before Christmas, I started going through stuff that I'd recorded on my DVR. But never gotten around to watching. Amongst these was the Hammer film Fanatic from 1965, albeit in a US print titled Die, Die, My Darling. This was a relatively early example of what is apparently known as the psycho-biddy subgenre, a type of film that stars some fading female star considered by Hollywood to be too old to play leads anymore in a convoluted Grand Guignol-style plot, emphasising the horrific elements. This particular example starred Tallulah Bankhead and featured all of the tropes that the Hammer version of this subgenre would reuse in subsequent variants, namely the crazy old female relative who imprisons and psychologically tortures a girlfriend of their son stroke grandson stroke nephew they deem unsuitable in their rambling old house. This one co-stars Stephanie Powers as the imperiled girl, a role she was pretty much to repeat in a subsequent Hammer entry in the subgenre, Crescendo from 1969, this time with Margaretta Scott, although Joan Crawford was originally sought for the role of the psycho biddy. It also threw in Crazy Twin Sons for good measure. This subgenre enjoyed a spurt of popularity during the 60s and to a lesser extent the early 70s, all kicked off by Robert Aldrich's Whatever Happened to Baby Jane from 1962, which had starred Bette Davis and Joan Crawford. All manner of directors got in on it, working on variations. Remember, even William Castle had a variation on it with Joan Crawford. But just why did Aldrich's film spark a subgenre at this particular time? The pat answer, of course, is that by the 60s, there are plenty of aging female film stars around, ripe to be exploited by producers, taking advantage of traditional Hollywood sexism and ageism to squeeze their stardom one last time by starring them in vehicles they wouldn't have touched with a barge pole during their prime. I can't help but feel, though, that there was more to it than that, and the popularity of these films, particularly the Hammer variation with young female heroines, is inextricably linked to the period in which they were made. The most obvious subtext is one of age's jealousy of youth. How else can one interpret scenarios where older women played by actresses who in their youth had been known for their beauty, imprisoning and persecuting attractive young women played by beautiful young actresses? Young women, incidentally, who are usually also threatening to usurp them as their younger male relatives' main female interest. Bearing in mind that the 60s saw the rise of youth culture in the West, with the young increasingly idolised in the form of pop performers, film stars, fashion models and so on, it shouldn't be any surprise that this subgenre should flourish at this precise moment in time. Adding fuel to the fire was the fact that those actually making films at this time were themselves predominantly middle-aged, jealously trying to preserve their position against a rising tide of younger talent, while at the same time trying to exploit it on screen. They doubtless found this subgenre of film, featuring the persecution of youth by representatives of the old established order, quite satisfying, playing to their own fears and insecurities. Then again, I could be reading far too much into what, at the end of the day, are simply exploitation films.
In this house, a great composer lived.
You know, there are times, many times, when I feel my husband still here. I hear his voice, his footsteps, and his music.
He is dead, but his music is very much alive. Terrifyingly alive.
Room. Is that where your husband did most of his work?
Yes, it is.
Mother's personal shrine to father. No one's allowed in there, right, Mother?
In this house of secrets, four people dwell. The stricken, the obsessed, the sensuous, the sinister. To this house comes a girl, innocent of its intrigue, exposed to its menace, singled out as its next victim.
Tell me about her. What was her name?
Catherine.
Danielle, why are you doing this?
Doing what?
Trying to make me into Catherine.
Susan, you must leave, even though I beg you to stay.
You must remember, my darling, it is I who you need.
Everything is ready, eh, madame?
When?
Whenever you like.
As the night falls, the music rises. Before the music dies, so will someone else.
They're really scraping the bottom of the barrel when it comes to celebrity cancellations now, aren't they? I mean, Gino De Campo? For Christ's sake, he's barely a celebrity, let alone a chef. His entire fame is based around the fact that he's an amusing foreigner with a funny accent and a penchant for gesticulating in a continental manner, something much beloved by the UK's TV programme makers. Except, of course, according to the latest shocking celebrity revelations, away from the cameras, he's anything but amusing, allegedly harassing female co-workers with sexual comments and inappropriate behaviour. As ever, I caveat this piece by noting that, at present, these are simply allegations. Nothing has been proven in a court of law, and everyone is innocent until proven guilty. That said, I'm not quite sure what the media thinks that we should all be shocked by the idea that Gino De Campo might be a wrong'un, when, as I recall, he had a previous career as a burglar. In fact, he burgled Paul Young's house, stealing several guitars, amongst other things. Which fact surely disproves all those nonsensical claims that, these days, a celebrity only has to commit a single minor misdemeanour, and they find themselves cancelled for life, their career in ruins. Clearly this is bollocks, as being a burglar is apparently no barrier to becoming a celebrity chef. And interestingly, as a side note, DeCampo was once George Michael's personal chef. Maybe he used Paul Young as a reference. But getting back to the original point, are we now at the stage where all the really well-known celebrities who can be outed as bastards, nonces and abusers have been outed? Have the rest been investigated and found to be whiter than the driven snow? Either that or they've armed themselves with better lawyers? Or is this Gina DeCampo business the result of ITV feeling that it has to keep up with the BBC, who got a lot of attention when Greg Wallace was being vilified as a sex fiend, so felt they had to reveal one of their culinary celebrities as an alleged abuser? If so, it hasn't really worked, as the DeCampo revelations haven't generated anywhere near the level of media hatred that the Wallace ones did, possibly because even before the allegations against him, Wallace was such an easy public figure to hate, coming over as pompous, pretentious and overbearing. Which I suspect has a lot to do with which public figures see their careers completely wrecked by such allegations, and which can be rehabilitated, and which seem to walk away unscathed. If the public already has a poor perception of them, they don't stand a chance of coming back from such accusations. People are already keyed up to think the worst of them. Just look at Russell Brand, whose descent into conspiracy theories, extreme right-wing politics and religious lunacy simply compounded public perceptions of him as an arsehole, to the point that when he was accused of abusing women, people just shrugged and said, "Yeah, so what? What's surprising about that?" As far as DeCampo is concerned, having already weathered the burglary business, youthful indiscretions, it might well be that his otherwise subsequent unblemished image as a cheeky chappy might just be enough to save him. For now.
She's sure not in pain. Oh, don't tell me you never heard of it. Didn't you learn anything in that school? It was more like a game, out of curiosity. Curiosity about love or curiosity about perversion? The church was for centuries attacked for using methods of penitence which were considered to be against every law of personal sanctity. No religious order escaped the accusations. Without exception, the nuns, friars, and priests were continually plagued with protests that the corporal punishments inflicted were for their sexual pleasure. Got anything to say against that?
It's quite true. I know all about that kind of penitence.
Well, it still exists today?
Sure does.
You mean that those methods are still practiced in the 20th century?
What does the year have to do with it?
Where did you get that book? Under a bunch of things you put in that drawer.
What? Are you spying on me now?
I wanted to know you better, that's all. So I looked around.
And what did you discover, if anything?
In souvenir of the unforgettable hours that we spent together here, the only brightness in the otherwise gray world of a convent. And signed, your roommate, Sophie.
Give me that book, Jackie.
Tell me, did you and your roommate get as close as we are right now?
1977's Vanessa is another of those films that came out in the wake of the success of 1974's Emmanuel and its sequels, when it briefly looked as if softcore porn was going mainstream and respectable. A German production, Vanessa is not dissimilar to another Emmanuel-inspired movie, the Australian-made Felicity, which came out around the same time. Both involve young women thrust from exclusive all-girls schools into the heady, not to mention hedonistic, milieu of 70s Hong Kong. The titular heroine of Vanessa leaves her convent school, staffed by teachers and nuns who still believe in corporal punishment for misdemeanors such as being caught looking at nudes and books about ancient Rome, finds herself in Hong Kong after the death of her last living relative, Uncle Richard, where she finds that she has inherited a chain of brothels and a plantation. From there, the plot follows a familiar path with the title character's sexual awakening, as she is introduced to various aspects of sex, including lesbianism, obligatory in 70s sex movies, although she never actually loses her virginity, whilst various dramatic subplots unfold around her. Chief of these involve the plantation's manager, who is contesting her inheritance with the claim that he is actually Uncle Richard's illegitimate son, and the attempts of both said manager and another old family friend to seduce her. the friend's wife is being bonked by the plantation manager at the same time. Along the way, there's also some business involving a mystic and an attempt by the jealous girlfriend of the plantation manager to use a form of voodoo against Vanessa. She thrusts a knife into the groin of a doll fashioned after the girl, causing her intense vaginal pain. Vanessa comes over like a compendium of adolescent male sexual fantasies, with its constant parade of naked young girls who always seem to avoid actually having sex with anyone. Flashbacks involving lesbianism, female masturbation and spanking are all there as well. At one point, the mystic demonstrates his powers by having non-physical remote sex with Vanessa whilst they sit at opposite ends of a dining table, which of course sends the girl off into a series of orgasmic fantasies, which again seems suspiciously like the kind of fantasies that adolescent boys would have about young women. The film tries to emulate the visual style of Emmanuel with lots of soft focus camera work and arty camera angles to give the whole thing a dreamlike sort of feel. Unfortunately, though, none of this helps to raise the film above the level of mediocrity, with its over-familiar plot, languid pace, and not especially interesting characters. It never really makes anything of its Hong Kong locations, let alone the fact that Vanessa is heir to a chain of bordellos, and none of the cast seem particularly enthusiastic about any of the antics they're required to perform. Anton Differing as Major Cooper, the family friend who tries to have his wicked way with Vanessa, is, in the English language version, dubbed with an English accent straight out of a 30s drama about the Raj, making his performance seem even more detached. Olivia Pascal, in the title role, in her film debut, is certainly attractive enough, but never really convinces as an ingenue. The biggest problem the film has is that it comes across as just too, well, respectable, seemingly content to hint at sexual depravities and deviancies, rather than actually show them properly, for fear of offending that new mainstream porn audience it was clearly aiming for. In truth, its Australian rival Felicity, although itself a pretty mild sex comedy, is actually far livelier and therefore more entertaining than Vanessa.
I've heard that the Queen Mother didn't really die in 2002. Apparently she only kicked the bucket last year in an old people's home in Hove and was buried in a pauper's grave.
That's just bollocks, isn't it? Why did they say she was dead and have that state funeral and everything if she wasn't brown bread, eh?
Apparently she was tired of being waited on hand and foot, running up massive overdrafts and having her every trivial whim accommodated, so she faked her own death. She wanted to spend her last days living like an ordinary person, didn't she?
Well, my mate reckons he saw her living as a bag lady near Waterloo Station in London, sleeping in a cardboard box and swigging meths with the other winos. He said the big floppy hat she was wearing and the crown wrapped in a Tesco carrier bag in the trolley she was pushing were dead giveaways. When he approached her, she launched into a tirade of abuse at him before demanding money for a cup of tea. When he last saw her, she was snogging some hairy old tramp with matted snot and dog crap in his beard.
Oi, stop disrespecting the Queen's mum. She was a top lady. Don't you know she single-handedly saved Britain from Hitler in World War II? And she had affairs with Errol Flynn, Frank Sinatra and Jimi Hendrix and probably had Princess Diana assassinated. I know towards the end, she smelled of wee, but that's no reason to take the piss. Now, tickets please.
I suppose that one benefit of Elon Musk currently being Trump's ass-kisser-in-chief and financial hatchet man is that this might at least distract him from his usual nonsense. You know what I mean. Rockets to Mars or usually all over Florida in pieces. The robots, wrecking social media sites, encouraging Nazis, eugenics and the like. Because I fear that his next obsession might involve a couple of these hobbies as he tried to develop robotic Nazis. It just seems like the obvious next step for him, bearing in mind his apparent inability to relate to actual living and breathing human beings and his control freakery. Despite having developed a passion for extreme right-wing politics, particularly in the UK and Germany, he's already had a serious falling out with Nigel Farage, with the Reform Party leader apparently not meeting Musk's high standards for potential authoritarian dictators. He just wasn't right-wing enough, refusing to commit to the political suicide of embracing convicted mortgage fraudster and violent football hooligan turned rabble-rouser Stephen Yaxley Lennon stroke Tommy Robinson. It can surely only be a matter of time before he has a similar falling out with Germany's AfD, probably when he finds out that they don't have plans to invade Poland and Russia and subjugate the whole EU under a fascist tyranny with him as their Führer. The answer, obviously, is for him to create robots programmed with fascism. They'd be unfailingly devoted to the cause, and Elon. Hitler salute, goose step perfectly, and best of all, have no moral qualms about sending minorities and political opponents to concentration camps. Now, you might think I'm being ridiculous here, but trust me, clockwork Nazis would be a perfectly logical step for someone like Musk. Not only would they be unfailingly obedient, but in appearance they could encompass the Aryan ideals for physical appearance. Even now, he's probably got people training AI on Nazi ideology, which is maybe why he's effectively turned Twitter into an extremist sex cesspool, where racism, misogyny, anti-Semitism, homophobia, transphobia, and just about every form of hate you can think of seems not just to be tolerated, but welcomed with open arms. It is going to form the database base for the fascist AI, which is going to power his Nazi robots. Doubtless, they'll also use that footage of his definitely non-Nazi salute to train them how to perform the perfect fascist greeting. But would he stop at creating an army of goose-stepping automatons? How about those pesky senators and representatives of both parties who might try to hold Trump to account and obstruct his most outrageous policies? Why not replace them with automated lookalikes? Or even just create new robot candidates so sophisticated they can pass for human who can run against them in primaries. Before you know, maybe even Trump will be replaced by an AI simulation controlled by billionaire supervillain Musk. Actually, an AI simulation might actually be a better president than the real Trump. Certainly, it would surely possess more humanity than the real thing.
Time for our final thoughts. Remember, Tom from Wyoming was mad because he voted for a known fascist, but didn't like the fascist government we now have. He just wanted to see some brown people deported, not lose his Medicare. Crispin from Delaware was mad because he hadn't voted for a fascist, yet has still got a fascist government. Although he didn't vote for Harris either because he was sore at Joe Biden for not bombing Israel over Gaza. What's the moral of this? If you don't want fascism, don't vote for a fascist. But sometimes just not voting fascist isn't enough. You've got to vote for a non-fascist instead. All I know is it isn't my fault. I'm dead, so didn't vote. Good night and look after yourselves. Look after each other.